So in this retreat, we're giving talks on the five faculties, and the faculties are ordinary human capacities that you all have, we all have, and the question is how they're utilized and are they developed in a way that supports us. And today we come to the fifth faculty, which is wisdom, and wisdom is a very centrally important of the faculties because it's the faculty which leads to liberation or to freedom. It's said sometimes in Buddhism that wisdom is the mother of all the Buddhas, that the Buddhas themselves, to become a Buddha, become enlightened, requires wisdom. And one of the favorite definitions for wisdom that the Buddha gave, favorite for me, is that wisdom is, or it actually did not define the abstract, because wisdom is kind of abstract, but and defined in terms of who a wise person is. A wise person is someone who benefits themselves, someone who benefits others, and someone who benefits both self and others. And not just benefiting oneself, not just benefiting others, but benefiting both and self and others, which I understand to mean maybe the greater good, taking everyone into account. And so, what a wonderful thing it'd be if we lived in a world where we were all concerned with benefiting each other, and we left the world in a better place than we came. We left a retreat center in a better place than we found it, or left a, any situation, any gathering of friends. We contribute there to offer benefit. What other definition of wisdom could be more meaningful than that? I wonder. So the question is, how do we benefit ourselves and others? And is wisdom something esoteric, something complex, and that we have to kind of get a PhD in Buddhism to understand? Or is it something that's quite easily accessible and maybe obvious? To define a wise person as someone who benefits self and others is not a particularly philosophically sophisticated idea, but I still believe it's a quite profound one. So what is the wisdom of practice, the wisdom of the Buddhas? So I'd like to begin that by going back to the topic of faith and to read to you a passage from the suttas where the Buddha describes the birth of what Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as unwavering faith. However, the word unwavering in Pali, avijja, it means based on knowledge, based on knowing. So faith based on knowing. And it begins with a list, because you can't start Buddhism without lists. and he's going to list what here is called the imperfections that defile the mind. And I know some people cringe when they hear terms like that, imperfections defile the mind. And sometimes it's kind of, if you go back to the original Pali of the word, it means something like that which causes a lot of trouble. So that the things that trouble the mind, things that cause difficulties. So it says, covetousness and greed are imperfections that defile the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Anger is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Resentment is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Contempt is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Insolence is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Envy is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Avarice is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Deceit is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Fraud is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Obstinacy is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Rivalry is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Conceit is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Arrogance is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Vanity is an imperfection that defiles the mind. So these are the kind of things that are the opposite of benefiting us. And one of the things that happens when people practice mindfulness, like you have here, is we become increasingly sensitive to the cost of having these kinds of activities going on in our minds or in our hearts. And whereas sometimes in daily life we can be barreling along at the speed of our life and not really noticing that that we have these things going on for us, or we don't see the problems in them, we don't see the cost to ourselves or to others. And but as we get quieter and stiller and more sensitive, we can see that, I don't know if we want to call them a defilement, the defilement that defiles the mind or the heart, but you can see that it irritates, it grates, it just feels off somehow. And the more quiet and pure, the more quiet and whole the heart, the mind, our body becomes, the more certain kinds of activities kind of grate, or they feel like there's a loss of integrity or a loss of that sensitivity. It just doesn't feel right. And I think what happens in people under this practice, they become increasingly sensitive to their ethical behavior, to the activities of their mind, in a way that sometimes they feel troubled by it. But I think it's quite beautiful, it's quite wonderful that to have this heightened sensitivity, because that heightened sensitivity then is a stepping stone to doing something with it. And the approach to Buddhism, as I understand it, is never to be weighed down by the past or how you are, but to always look at the past, what you've done, or how your mind maybe is not quite something you want to be proud about, and not be weighed down by that, but in a certain kind of way be inspired by it, inspired to do better. And so then be forward-looking, looking forward into practice and how we could do better, how we can live better, live by other values. So we have to look back just enough to be honest about what we see in our hearts, in our mind, in our past, to get that inspiration or that energy or that, let's see if we can do better. Not weighed down, but buoyed by these things that we see. So a certain kind of inner honesty. So, and then it goes through the same list, but I won't read the whole thing this time, but you'll get the idea. Knowing that covetousness and greed are imperfections that defile the mind, a person abandons it. Knowing that ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a person abandons it. And it goes through all those that list. Knowing that they trouble the mind, knowing they grate the mind, knowing that they somehow cause trouble for the heart, and perhaps cause trouble for others as well, that the person abandons it. So it's easier said than done, but that's the movement. And so it maybe takes a while to abandon it, to let it fade away, let it drop away, to no longer have it as a problem. Might take a while, but that's the direction, it's possible. And once it's been abandoned, it's quite a special thing. Because when it's abandoned, you know that it's no longer there. You no longer have that trouble. You no longer have that problem. Now, is this how meaningful, how significant is this little movement? Letting go of greed, letting go of ill will, letting go of hostility, letting go of conceit, letting go of these things. What's left? When you let go, what replaces it? And I think that the Buddhist tradition suggests that when you let go well, it comes with joy, with lightness, with freedom, with ease. It's forward moving. It's beneficial to do it. And this passage, we'll talk about how it's beneficial in a moment when I read it. But to know for yourself, to really know for yourself what it's like to be troubled by these defilements of the mind, and to really know for yourself what it's like when they're not longer there, is a momentous occasion. And what we're encouraged to do is take in and let it register what it feels like not to have it there, even if it's just temporarily. If you're struggling with conceit, everything you do is self-referential in relationship to yourself, and you really start feeling what it's like to have conceit and always be me, myself, and mine, and then at some point you're able to put it down, then to take that in and be nourished by that, to to appreciate that, to feel what that's like, to feel the peace or the joy or the lightness, or however, I know different people maybe feel it different ways, but to see that difference, to experience that contrast, to be able to distinguish between these two different ways of being. And it takes a little bit of discernment, a little bit of memory, a little bit of consideration to take it in fully, because it requires remembering that a little while ago before I was caught up in conceit. And if you only stay in the present moment, boom, 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 and never kind of remember what it was like a few minutes ago when you had the conceit, then you won't take the full impact of what's changed, the benefit. So a little bit we do that occasionally, right? Take in. So to get a sense of how meaningful this movement is and how central it is to the whole enterprise that we're involved in here, when a person has known that covetousness and greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, and has abandoned it, that person then acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha. Or as it, I think a literal translation should be, acquires confidence based on knowing. Because you know something for yourself. You don't have to read a book that says, you know, it's a good idea to let go of greed. And then you maybe, because you read it, you think, well, I have confidence in it because you read it. But when you actually go through the process yourself, then you know for yourself. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi wants to call that unwavering confidence, because how important it is. But this is what gives birth to faith in the Buddha, confidence in the Buddha. So it's a personal reference point, something you refer to in your own experience, that gives you a sense or an understanding or a resonance with who the Buddha is, what the Buddha must have been like. Because the Buddha went through this process as well. So here, the reference to the enlightenment of the Buddha, the state of the Buddha, is not something esoteric. It's not some grand theory of a superhuman being who has, you know, infinite compassion and great, infinite, omnipotent understanding of the universe. The reference point for understanding the Buddha is your own mind, and is what could maybe be called a simple, not easy, transformation that you can go through. Greed and the absence of it. And then it goes on and says, if you do this, then the person acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, in the Dharma. And here we have the usual formula of the Dharma. And it's very interesting to listen to this and think of it as as arising out of seeing a defilement and seeing the defilement be abandoned or let go of. One acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. To be experienced by the wise for themselves. Again, the reference point is yourself, here. It's one of the reasons why mindfulness is so important, to be experienced for yourself, to be here, to in this invisible here, Dharma is visible here and now. Not because it's something, again, esoteric or abstract or metaphysical or strange, but because it's this very simple, ordinary movement of the mind, ordinary but difficult movement of the mind. Greed and abandoning greed. Ill will and abandoning ill will. Now, you might not feel that this is such a lofty goal for a world religion. You think that it's supposed to be connected to some lofty cosmic principles and realities and states and transcendental things. But you don't have to go very far into this world to see how much suffering this world has, to realize that and to realize that our suffering has a beginning in people who are caught up in the defilements of the mind. And given the suffering and given the roots of the suffering, doing this work to cleanse and to clean or to let go is probably, I think, one of the most profound things a person can do. And I think that's why, you know, this is highlighted here. It's through this that you have confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. When one has given up, released, abandoned, in part, I love this that it has here, in part. So we don't have to have, you know, you don't have to kind of like do it all at once, just in part, modestly at first. Having given up, released, and abandoned in part these imperfections, one considers, I am now possessed of confidence based on knowing, my own knowing, in the Buddha. And in doing that, the person gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains gladness connected to the Dharma. When the person is glad, rapture is born. When the person is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. When the body is tranquil, one feels happy. When one feels happy, the mind becomes concentrated. So here we have a little bit the movement that we've been talking about. Not all the steps, but faith, and then concentration. And then we're getting to wisdom. So wisdom here is being able to see distinctions. And the faculty of wisdom we're talking about is a faculty, it's a capacity, it's a functioning of the mind, as opposed to knowledge acquired. Sometimes wisdom is knowledge. You can learn something, read something. But here, because it's a faculty, an activity, a functioning of the mind, it's not about learning something, but it's rather it's utilizing that faculty in a particular way, or utilizing that faculty. And so what is the faculty of wisdom? And the best that I could understand from these ancient texts and from my teachers is that it means to be discerning, to have discernment, to be able to look at things and distinguish between what is wise and what is not wise, to distinguish between what causes harm and what doesn't, to be able to make distinctions between what is helpful and what is not helpful. And it takes a certain kind of functioning of the mind to be able to compare or contrast in a healthy, appropriate way between these two sides. What is appropriate to pursue or engage in because it's helpful and beneficial, and what is not helpful to pursue because it's not beneficial. So it's a very simple evaluation, kind of dichotomy or distinction, to be able to make that distinction. Because if you can find your way between what is helpful and not helpful, then you can maybe see the place of choice where you can start acting on what's helpful as opposed to what's not helpful. So that's part of the function of mindfulness and its concentration of getting still and stable in the mind, is to place us carefully in our life so we can be discerning, we can see clearly enough what's happening so we can make distinctions between what is helpful and not helpful. So you, in meditation, on retreat, you might sit here, sit in a fantasy, and might take a while before it dawns on you that it's not really that helpful to spend more time in the fantasy. And so when it dawns on you, then you have a choice. And then the question is, do you exercise the choice to let go of what's not helpful and do what's more helpful, to maybe to wake up and be present? You might notice that you have back pain, and you might notice also that there's a lot of self-hate for being a person who has back pain. If you're really a good Buddhist, you would sit there with in bliss and not have any pain. So it must be a personal failing. It must be a personal failing that your back hurts. So if you're, you know, it might take a while. It's unfortunate sometimes that wisdom comes slow. But it might take a while to notice that, you know, I keep thinking this way that, you know, I hate myself because of my bad back or whatever it might be. And then, but then you step back and you ask this question. This is the question of wisdom. Is this helpful or is this not helpful to think this? It's a little bit different question than is it true or not true? Because I think it's a little bit dangerous to ask the question it's true, because some minds have lawyers and public relation firms and political strategists and speech writers who will do a really good job arguing that it's true. I am really crummy. I'm lousy, you know, and this is the reasons why. So it's dangerous to ask is it true or not true, because, you know, that firm you have in there will, you know, marshal its forces and argue its case. But if you ask is it helpful or not helpful, maybe then there's more chance for wisdom, more something useful information to have. And you say, well, it's not useful. I don't even pay them. And so is it useful? If it's useful, not useful, then you have a choice. And if you can abandon it, let go, great. But that's easier said than done. But maybe the choice is maybe not to. Maybe you can't abandon it, but maybe the choice is to step away from it slightly. Maybe the choice is not to believe in it quite as much, not to invest so much of your self, your beliefs, your arguments, everything in it. Step back from it. See it. See it rather than believe it. And that can be a very significant movement. So there's a whole, you know, there's a whole gamut of things we can point to. Is it helpful or not helpful? We sit here, how we think, how we are. So with a bad back, you can then eventually ask the question, is it helpful to sit with a bad back or is it not helpful? And there are times when, in a certain kind of way, it can be helpful to sit with a painful back in meditation. And other times it's not helpful. It's the function of wisdom to help us find that way. So I've sat with pain in my knees and my legs, my back, you name it. I've had it in meditation. That didn't come across very well. I've had it. I've had all those kinds of pain. And I've learned to distinguish between when I think it's useful to stay with the pain, be with it, and when I think it's not useful. If it's not useful, I have no hesitation to break the posture and not do it. So if it's going to be damaging, then it's not useful. If it's going to be so discouraging that I don't want to come back to meditate ever again, then it's not useful. But if I see an opportunity in this discomfort, in the pain, to develop my mind, to become a freer person, then sometimes I think, you know, I think I'm going to take this challenge, take this opportunity and work with it for a while and see how well all this works. I might learn that I have a lot of, there's a lot of things that come into play when there's pain. As I mentioned the other day, there could be self-pity. So I'm going to work with this self-pity thing and not have it so much when I'm in pain. I have a lot of aversion. I hate my pain. Maybe I can learn not to hate it. Maybe that's a big change. Maybe I can learn to be patient. Maybe I can learn what kind of thoughts I have. Maybe I can learn what my body does when I'm in pain, how I contract around it. Maybe I can just relax and soften around it. There's a variety of things that might be useful to learn. And if you feel that opportunity, then maybe it's useful to do it. But then you have to monitor yourself and then check in. Is this still being useful? And I believe if you're being mindful, carefully mindful, tuned into your body, you'll understand the signals that say, this is dangerous now, better move your posture. And most people anyway in our scenes are going to change their posture way before that anyway, I hope. This isn't Zen where they, you know, I can't tell you how many Zen students I know who've had knee surgery partly because you don't really learn to pay attention in Zen. So there's a careful attention to what's going on. Like, you know, Zen is great. I love Zen practice. It's a powerful and wonderful practice. I don't want to disparage it. But it's true that in Zen, the way we were trained, when you don't pay careful attention to what's really going on in the body, and you're not allowed to move. And so lots of people kind of just sat through pain they shouldn't have sat through. So the idea of, you know, what is useful, what is not useful, is a guide. Now, who is it who can tell you what is useful and not useful? Primarily, it's yourself. Occasionally, you can ask for some advice and support from other people, but the idea is to discover for yourself. Again, we're pointing back to ourselves as the reference point. Ourselves as the reference point. And it's something relatively ordinary. It's something that you can pick up, you can be sensitive to, you can know for yourself that where the wisdom is found. So, you know, the wisdom factor reflects back on the other faculties. So, you look at your energy level. And you can look and see, how is my energy right now? Is this a useful kind of energy or not useful energy? Maybe it's a little bit frantic or hyped up, the energy. You know, then you say, but it's not really useful to meditate with this hyped up energy. Maybe I need to do something to settle it. Or maybe the energy is almost absent. You know, you're kind of lethargic or very dull, the energy. And you notice that and say, what's useful? Is this useful to continue this way or not useful? And maybe it's useful to do something that brings more energy, do faster walking meditation, or there's a variety of things you can do. Or maybe it's what's useful is to, once you recognize the hyped up energy or the dull energy, what's useful here? Maybe what's useful is to look at it more carefully. What's going on when I'm hyped up? Look more. What's the ecology of hyped upness? What's the inner ecology of being dull energy? Or maybe you notice that you have a lot of aversion to either one. And so maybe what's useful is to stay with whatever is going on and explore and get to know better this aversion. And maybe you can free yourself of the aversion. And just be a person who's comfortable with being hyped up or comfortable with being dull. And then you can ask the question, given that I'm relaxed now about being hyped up or dull, what is useful and not useful? I don't think it's useful to be in either one of those places, so now I'll make an adjustment. I'll go for a walk. I'll take a nap. I'll go get some tea. You know, whatever is helpful. So you can, the wisdom faculty reflects back on the earlier faculties. You can look at your mindfulness. What kind of mindfulness is useful here? Sometimes mindfulness is helpful to have very precise mindfulness where you kind of like a microscope on your experience. And sometimes it's useful to have a panoramic mindfulness, very open, spacious. You can make, you know, which kind? Should I be close in and really be present? I think Andrea talked about, the teacher talked about rubbing with a cloth. So should I really be there, like rubbing and get it? Or should I step back and imagine on the other side of the vineyard, across the road there, looking back at myself. Because sometimes the inner turmoil can be so powerful that to get close to it and rub it, too identified, too caught up in it, and looking too carefully just kind of spins out. But if you can back off, step back, how big do you have to be, or how far distant do you have to look back at your anger or your fear, especially fear, and not be in its grip? So maybe, across the road, imagine you're over there looking back at yourself being afraid, and then it's okay to be with it. So these are ways of being mindful. So, the wisdom factors ask the question, what way is it useful to be? What way is it useful to be concentrated? Concentration also, Andrea talked about two different kinds of concentration yesterday, the more one-pointed, stable concentration, or the moment-to-moment stable concentration that stays there with shifting objects. Which one is useful? What serves you? Some people are not served by developing strong one-pointed concentration. It just doesn't do their system very good. Other people, it really creates a stability that allows them to see their experience in a good, deeper way. Other people are not served by the moment-to-moment experience because everything seems so chaotic and out of control, just like they were as a child growing up in my alcoholic family, where things were out of control. And I can't handle that anymore. And so perhaps what's needed then is more of the one-pointed stability to create a kind of a foundation that's a little bit healing, so that maybe eventually you can open up to a wider scope of things. So it's the wisdom factor that asks these questions. And then wisdom factor can also look at itself. So if the wisdom factor is being discerning as to looking at our experience through this vantage point of what is helpful and not helpful, then we can also ask, am I being discerning in a useful way or not, in a helpful way? Because the danger is that you listen to this talk too carefully, and then you, next sitting, you come down and you start analyzing everything. Is this useful, not useful, this is useful, and by the end of the sitting you have a headache. So wisdom looks at itself and hopefully very quickly realizes, this kind of way of just looking, is not helpful for me. Maybe Gil didn't mean to every second. So maybe there's still something to the talk, some value to it. Maybe. Let's give it a second try. And so you kind of say, well, maybe if I just do it kind of gently once in a while, ask the question, is this useful or not useful? And then you find every once in a while is a gentle kind of question that's not driven and trying to bore into everything, that then actually kind of guides you in a nice way. Oh, I guess some of that. So the wisdom factor corrects for itself too. Isn't that great? So you don't get, notice you're getting stressed. And so there again, mindfulness is helpful because then you ask, is this helpful or not helpful the way I'm doing it? Mindfulness, paying attention, tells you, well, I'm doing it in a way that's stressful. And so then you can make a correction. So in this way, we're learning to be our own teachers. We're learning to pay attention to ourselves, to our own experience. And that's where the Dharma is found. The Dharma is not found, in this heavy book that I have here. This heavy book, at the best, is a mirror that that we can see ourselves in. So to begin encouraging us to look back here at our state of mind, our state of heart, what's happening, to be able to read it. The real book that we read is the book in our heart. And to read it and see what is helpful, not helpful, what are things that are troublesome for us, that are painful to have, what can we abandon, and what are things that are beneficial for us, what are helpful. And I love it that here the description is almost like it's a natural process, that once you start this process of abandoning, letting go, and seeing how beneficial it is and how meaningful it is, that certain kind of gladness arises, certain kind of delight or satisfaction or meaningfulness arises, inspiration arises. Yes, this is good. And then such good things as joy, rapture, tranquility, happiness, and concentration kind of follow as we begin to appreciate this kind of thing. And this idea of gladdening the mind, making yourself happy, is very important, because the part of the function of the gladdening, the happiness, the tranquility, is not to be necessarily a kind of glad person or filled with rapture all the time, or the point, I don't think the point is exactly to be happy in this way or tranquil. But what happens is, it's very helpful because a tranquil, happy, concentrated mind is a softer mind. It's a mind which is not in the grip of clinging and resistance and hardness. And it's very hard, if you grip your hand in a really hard fist. I used to do that with my kids as a game. I would make a really hard fist and put my thumb inside. And their job was to capture my thumb. And, for a long time I was, master of my hand, and then I could keep the hand closed. They tried to pry open my fingers, but not anymore. So some things can't be done if you're really tight, but if your hand is soft or your mind is soft, your fingers, your hands can be used for all kinds of things. The hands are meant to be kind of useful, not just always in a fist. And so the part of the function, what's useful, is to find a way to soften and relax the heart and the mind. And this is one of the reasons in Buddhism why we put so much emphasis on concentration and joy and happiness, and is because we're trying to, and some people, maybe it's too much to talk about those terms, but maybe it's not too much to say, just relax. Relax is good. We're softening the mind, relaxing the mind. And that prepares the mind. It's a preparation for the mind to do some of the more deeper work of letting go in a much deeper way. The kinds of letting go are not that easy to do, it's helpful to prepare the mind, soften the mind, so that it can, when the time comes, open its fist of the heart. So here's a description of a man who did this, listening to the Buddha. His name is Upali. He was a householder, and the Buddha came to his house for a meal. And then the Buddha gave the householder Upali progressive instruction. That is, talk on giving, talk on virtue, talk on the heavens, talk on the danger of addiction to sensual pleasures, and the blessings of letting go, of renunciation. So, when the Buddha knew that the householder Upali's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated, and confident, he expounded to him the teaching special to the Buddhas. So a few things. So here the Buddha is giving a talk. We don't know what the content of this talk was, except for the subjects. But the effect of giving this talks was it inspired this man, so that his mind became ready, receptive, elated, and confident. So it's a tall order for a Dharma talk teacher to think that we're supposed to be doing this, but to listen to it. So something to talk about giving, that giving is not just a good idea to be generous, but there's something very inspiring about a world where people are generous. It's very meaningful to see people help each other, support each other, give, offer each other to help other people. And it's a beautiful thing to feel and sense that, and then to be inspired. Do you guys know Mr. Rogers? Some of you know Mr. Rogers. He's probably the one of the few American saints. And he was going to be given, I think, a Academy Award for something for his TV show. So all these people are sitting in the Academy Awards with their suits and ties and tuxedos and nice, these movie stars, right? And it's on television. Live. And so they ask Mr. Rogers to come up and get his award. And he gets up to give a little talk, and he says, all of you here are here because someone, some point in your life, believed in you, supported you. Let's take a minute in silence to remember them. And as I read this account, the movie producers are like frantic, what we do. A minute of silence on television? What a thing, a minute of silence. And so they just panned the audience for that minute, and people were crying. So, you know, it's quite beautiful, this thing of being generous, and to take it in and feel it and know it. And then a talk on virtue. When I was younger, teenager and stuff, I thought I didn't have a high opinion of virtue. But now I have a very high opinion of it because it's so beautiful, it's so profound, it's such a wonderful thing, and it's so meaningful for this world that we live in, when there's such tremendous amount of lack of it, and how much, when you see how much harm that causes. So be inspired by the virtue, inspired by a good heart. So he goes on. So Pali is ready, receptive, elated, and confident. And then the Buddha expounded the teaching special to the Buddhas. So this is kind of a nice run-in. What is the special teachings of the Buddhas? Suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. So the special teaching, again, is something very ordinary. It's the ordinary world of suffering that we all experience. In other places that's called the truth, even a noble truth, the truth of suffering. So the importance of noticing and being aware of it. If we whitewash our life, then we don't have access to this deeper source of wisdom, this discernment, the seeing where freedom is found. But not just to suffer for its own sake, but to suffer so that we can see the origin, the cause, the conditions that give rise to it. Because everything arises because of causes and conditions, and we're not stuck in any way in our suffering. It's possible to find freedom. It's possible because things are part of a chain of cause and effect are conditioned. So to see its origin, its conditioning, where it comes from, and then to see its cessation, the letting go. In this earlier text I read, the abandonment of greed and ill will and such things. Abandonment kind of means the same thing as seizing of it, relinquishing of it, and the path to relinquishing it. While the householder of Pali sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. The spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma. So the Dharma eye. So again, he saw something. He didn't understand something. He wasn't like, wow, that made a lot of sense. There was something about hearing about these suffering, the origins, the cessation, that he saw something. Again, probably because his mind was ready. It was quiet. And probably what he could see in that quiet mind is he could see how it worked for himself in his mind. That's the reference point. And with that came the understanding. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. All that is subject to arising, everything that arises and produced and is created, is also subject to fading away, to disappearing. Everything, there's no exception. If it arises, it will pass away. Is this depressing news? Or is this encouraging news? For Upali, it was liberating news. This was his understanding. When he heard about these Four Noble Truths, this was the understanding that rose in his mind, that freed him some way. It's all change. Then the householder Upali saw the Dhamma, attained the Dhamma, understood the Dhamma, fathomed the Dhamma. He crossed beyond doubt, did away with perplexity, and became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. Become independent of others. Now, I think that's quite a powerful statement. That there's a vision, a seeing, not just an understanding exactly, but deeper than understanding, but to actually see something about the nature of how our mind works. See something about the nature of this world of impermanence, the arising and passing of it. And then in that world of change, in that world of impermanence, in that world where we see clinging arise, maybe we see it go away, that to discover how to be independent, independent of others, but independent in the Dharma. So to be able, when I was studying in Japan, the teacher I studied with there defined Dharma transmission, when you're ready for Dharma transmission, as a person who is able to stand on their own 2 feet in the Dharma. So you know the Dharma for yourself. You don't have to go to big books like this for the Dharma. You don't have to rely on other teachers for the Dharma. You know something really for yourself. And what is it you know? You know suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path to it. And if that's too complicated, then it's to know the hang-ups, the defilements, the strains that the mind is under, and to know the abandonment of it, the letting go of it. Right there is the Dharma. The Dharma that's visible here and now, for a long time when I heard this expression, Dharma visible here and now, I thought it was something really esoteric. You know, yes, it's visible here and now if you somehow put on laser eyes, or I don't know what. You were in the 8th, 9th, 10th jhana, and you know, I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought it was something, this big secret. But visible here and now, it's something you can experience. It's relatively ordinary, and I trust that all of you in your long life so far, you could look back over your lifetime and remember something that troubled you that doesn't trouble you anymore. Whatever it was that troubled you was subject to arising, it was subject to cessation. Or your relationship to it, the way you clung to it or resisted it or fought it or afraid of it, that's subject to origination, it's arising, and it can pass away. And seeing the arising and passing of it, there's a stepping back from it all, or standing on your own 2 feet in the midst of it all, so you're not pushed around by the storms of life. You're not caught in the storms of life. You just kind of stand there, upright, independent of it all, not dependent on anything, not looking for other places, not looking towards others, not looking to other places and other things and to special experiences to do it for you, but to find it here in the simple movement of the mind of staying free, not grasping, not holding down. So to become independent in the Dharma. So again, the reference point is yourself. You know, you're so important. Each of us is considered precious, valuable, important. And how do we care for ourselves? And the beautiful thing is, as we care for ourselves in this way, then we're able to care for the world as well. There's a direct relationship between the two of them. As we benefit ourselves this way, then we become people who can then benefit others. And we have a world that it's really good if a few more of us would help out. And how do we help? We help with wisdom, which means we look, is this helpful how I'm helping? Or is it not helpful? And sometimes we help too much and it harms. So you have to kind of always be discerning, always come back to this discernment. it helps us to find our way with the freedom. Let's end with a short sitting, short kind of gathering together. So earlier I talked about a path that goes from A to A. So as you sit here, the Dharma is here and now, visible here and now. What can you let go of? How can you settle down, settle in? So that you're more here, not looking elsewhere. What are you doing that's not particularly helpful, that you can lighten up on or step aside from? So that you can be more fully here.